All right. Enough fun. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Today's the 13th of February, 2025. The time is 1:37 p.m. Present today are representatives of Hannon, Bynum, Stapp, Galvin, Jimmy, Co-Chair Foster, myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are our House Finance Committee staff. We have Representative Allard with a...
I do.
I saw them live in Anchorage a long time ago, but donuts. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, a committee assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Reed Gardinier, Secretary Bree Wiley, Secretary Leah Frazier. We had a very good meeting this morning, grateful for it, on Medicaid and its function and basically all its elements. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we will hear the Department of Health present its FY26 budget overview. With us today from the department is Commissioner Heidi Hedberg, Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie, Assistant Commissioner Pam Halloran. If the three of you will please come forward, put yourselves on the record, you can begin your presentations.
For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health. And to my left is Pam Halloran, Assistant Commissioner. And to my right is Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie. And behind me, I have Director Deb Etheridge to answer specific questions about DPA. So on July 1st, 2024, 2023, the Department of Health and Social Services reorganized into two different departments. And so we are the Department of Health. We are made up of the five divisions that you see on this organizational chart. What I want to acknowledge is that in and through each and every one of these divisions, as a smaller department, we really have been able to just deep dive into operations and really build a strong leadership team with an amazing staff. And they really are focused. We are all focused on our mission, which is promoting the health, the well-being, and self-sufficiency of all Alaskans. What I would like to call out for you is that as a new department, we have been working on a new website. And so our new website will be launching soon-ish. I said this winter, but I feel like I should say this spring, only because it's sunny outside. And the website's going to move from a repository of information to a user-based journey. So currently, right now, you'd have to know where the program is within a division. And most Alaskans don't know that. It's going to be a completely different website. And so on the home page, an individual will be able to type in a program. That program will come up with associated programs. It's really to help ensure that we are providing access and information to Alaskans that are looking for one item, but there may be related programs associated with that. This new website is going to be mobile-friendly, and that will be the first phase. The second phase is going to be language. And so we have five languages that will be launched. It is Spanish, Tagal, Korean, Russian, and Hmong. We do recognize that Yupik is a common spoken language in Alaska, but we have not been able to secure a language bank with Yupik. So if you have any connections with a Yupik language bank, we would love to know so we could absorb that and put it and translate it our website. Okay. We will also have the chatbot features so that, again, we're trying to make it easier for Alaskans to find information on our new website.
Commissioner, we've been joined by Representative Tomaszewski. Please continue.
For the record, my name is Pam Halloran. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health. Slide 3 provides a quick department overview for you. We have 1,557 permanent full-time staff. Our budget is just over $3.5 billion. Medicaid represents 80% of our overall budget request, and operations that support Medicaid or are outside of Medicaid represent $695 million. $290 million of that is UGF. Next slide, please. Slide 4 provides a comparison of the department's budget from FY24 through FY26. The governor's budget reflects 29% of the department's overall request, while federal authority represents 67%. Designated general fund and other reflect a significantly smaller portion of the budget at 1% and 3%. Designated general fund for the department includes, but is not limited to, the tobacco education and cessation funds, alcohol and drug treatment and prevention funds, recidivism reduction funds, and marijuana education and treatment funds. Other funding for the department reflects interagency receipt authority, the PFD fund, mental health trust authority funds, statutory designated program receipts, and the restorative justice account. Slide 5 highlights the Medicaid services appropriation, which with a budget of just over $2.8 billion. The Medicaid budget reflects a single change, which is a reversal of a multi-year appropriation for Inter-I. This is an assessment tool for individuals seeking Medicaid community-based waiver services or professional care services. This appropriation for Inter-I was a collaboration between disability advocates, the legislature, and the department, and will continue into FY26.
Assistant Commissioner, we've been joined by Representative Johnson as well. Please continue.
Slide 6 provides a comparison of the Medicaid services budget from 24 into 26. General fund represents 26% and federal represents 74% of the Medicaid budget. The department provided Medicaid projections to the legislature December 15th and will provide updated projections next week. Providing these later projections ensures that the department can address items that can drastically impact the Medicaid budget that simply aren't known when we're building our budget early in fall.
Okay. Slide 7.
Slide 7 highlights healthcare services. The Division of Healthcare Services, excuse me. This division provides oversight of Medicaid operations, including the Medicaid Management Information System, the Medicaid Recovery and Reclamation, Medicaid Systems Analysis, Background Check Determinations, Health Facility Licensing and Certification, Residential Facility Licensing and Certification, and Medicaid Policy and Communications. I wanted to highlight a single budget change in this component, which is a $962,500 request within the health facilities licensing and certification allocation. That request, which comprises of 295 federal and 667,500 general fund match, aligns budgeted authority to actual expenditures for this component. To date, the division has met its budgetary needs through vacancy savings and transfers from other areas of the healthcare services division. Additional authority is necessary for health facilities licensing and certification to meet its statutory obligation of licensing and investigating Title 18 and 19 health facilities. The authority is needed to maintain sufficient staff for state federal certification of health facilities in Alaska, including healthcare hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, hospice programs, home health agencies, rural health clinics, and other types of health facilities.
Okay.
Slide 8 highlights the healthcare services budget. UGF represents 34% of their budget, and federal represents 53%. The DGF represents general fund program receipts for the division's background check program, which in FY24 performed 23,310 background check determinations.
Chair Josephson.
Sorry.
Ms. Halloran.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Ms. Halloran, would you repeat that number again of how many background checks?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that is 23,310 background checks.
Thank you.
Okay. Slide 9 looks familiar.
For the record, my name is Emily Ricci, and I'm Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Health, and slide 9 is familiar. This is part of what we discussed with the committee this morning. But healthcare services, the Division of Healthcare Services, is also the entity that is responsible for two programs that are critical to leveraging savings in our Medicaid program. Those include tribal reclaiming, so opportunities to receive 100% federal match for certain services that are provided to tribal members who are also Medicaid eligible, as well as leveraging drug rebate recoveries for the pharmaceutical spend. You'll see the total tribal reclaiming has grown from its initiation in FY 2017 from $34 million up to $138 million in fiscal year 2024. What we're seeing currently is about $25 million in general fund savings per quarter. In terms of drug rebate recoveries, $25 million per month, not per quarter. In terms of drug rebate recoveries, we are also actively pursuing any opportunities to recover additional dollars to offset the costs of our pharmaceuticals in the Medicaid program. There are two types of rebate recovery programs, federal rebates, which are available to any Medicaid providers in all states, and then supplemental rebates. So with the buildup of the pharmacy team and healthcare services over the last 6 years or so, we have been able to leverage $138 million in federal rebates, and what's not shown on the slide is an additional $26.8 million in supplemental rebates that we have also received. Those savings are shared between the federal government and the state agency.
We have a question from Representative Stapp, then Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Chair Joseph, through the chair to our wonderful folks at the Department of Health. So a couple of years ago, we kind of looked at the staffing in this program specifically for tribal reclaiming and rebates, and we added some folks. And I'm just curious if you could speak briefly about how that has been working out for the department through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. That has been working out very well. We are seeing, again, that increase in supplemental rebates that would not have been possible without the work with the additional positions through the pharmacy team. In terms of tribal reclaiming, you are also seeing an increase in the annual amount of additional federal match we are able to receive to offset general fund services. I would note there is a slight decline between fiscal year 23 and fiscal year 24 in relation to overall drug rebate recoveries, and that's actually a reflection of a drop in pharmaceutical spend over that same time period. So proportionally, it is still growing in terms of rebates as a savings to offset the overall pharmaceutical cost.
And a quick follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank Co-Chair Joseph through the chair. I figured this would be a good slide to ask about the good old Department of or the Office of Healthcare Savings and how that's going, if you would, Commissioner. Thank you. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. The Office of Health Savings is an office that was developed in the Commissioner's office. It's really a team made up of three people. We think about them as our idea engine. So they are focused on helping identify and pursue opportunities for the department to save money through different through pursuing different innovations. You can imagine on a day-to-day basis, we have incredible directors with significant amount of experience, but the day-to-day activities can really suck up the time that it takes to think about how to think about innovating ideas. And so the Office of Health Savings is really a way for the Commissioner's Office to have dedicated staff to think about those innovations, whether they're different waivers or different opportunities, and then to support the divisions and working to implement those. To date, the Office of Health Savings has brought in several million dollars in technical assistance and grants over the last year. They have also been working with the Department of Law to add two different positions to support additional subrogation activities that have resulted in about a 30% increase in subrogation activities overall with those positions. And I can provide more information in writing on the subrogation increases.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. And I hope this request isn't too onerous, but as we go through the slides, I'm going through a lot of these budget overviews, and a lot of departments are showing us how they're spending money, but they haven't, a lot of them don't demonstrate their revenue streams as coming in, that has generalized them as UGF funding. When we're going through the programs, if there's highlights of revenue that we're getting, and then you did point out a good one here with pharmacy rebates, if there's other things that we are bringing into the department as far as offsets for expense, it would be helpful if you just highlight that. I'd appreciate it.
Deputy Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. This is not depicted in the slide, but it is in a report that was published and shared with the legislature earlier, the annual Medicaid reform report. But, you know, typically with insurance programs, there are certain requirements regarding who pays first in the event that an individual may be covered under multiple policies or in the event of a car accident where someone is injured and their policy may not be, their insurance plan may not be, you know, at the end of the day, responsible for primary costs associated with that. We think about those as subrogations or third-party payments. And so that is a really important part of the work that healthcare services does. And I would say the recovery of those payments where Medicaid may have paid in the primary position but is later determined to not have been the primary payer, some other payer is, that is another source of revenue and savings that come back into the Medicaid program.
Yeah, follow up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice. And just for clarity, I'm not requesting at this time that when we're going through these slides that you'd go through every one of those details. But just if something comes to mind that's of significance, and just remind us where we might be able to go look for that additional details would be helpful. And I can always follow up offline when something comes to mind specifically with a revenue issue or revenue item. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Slide 10.
For the record, this is Pam Halloran, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Health. Slide 10 highlights the Division of Public Assistance with a budget of just over $306 million. The Division of Public Assistance provides eligibility determinations for 9 public assistance programs. They administered the Senior Benefits Payment Program. Significant budget changes for this division include a budget increase that reflects the department's fiscal note for SB 189 that did not get attached to the bill in the late hours of session closeout last year. A reversal of one-time funding for 2 items, including a child care grant program and food, and a one-time item for food security. And the reversal of multi-year funding for Medicaid eligibility determinations and for addressing the SNAP backlog. The 2025 reflects the final year of both of those multi-year appropriations.
All right. We're going to have a lot of questions, I think, on this slide. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. First question is with regard to the SNAP backlog reversal. I did see at slide 13 your goal was to make sure that SNAP is delivered efficiently and in a timely way. I presume that this means that you're all set up and you're already no more wait lists and such, so I just want to double check on that.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner, through the chair, Representative Galvin, thanks for that question. It's important to note that these one-time multi-year appropriations met their original intent. So when I started in this role as commissioner back in November of 2022 and Director Etheridge started in January of 2023, we were faced with a significant backlog. There were 36,000 applications across all programs. And one point of clarification, there's about 17 different types of public assistance programs in the division, 9 predominant ones. And so there was a huge backlog. Of the 36,000, 13,000 was SNAP. And so we went before the legislature. We asked for an appropriation to provide funding to support us to address that immediate need. In addition, that is when Medicaid redetermination started as well, and we're talking about the exact same staff that process Medicaid and SNAP. And so that's where you see the 2 different multi-year appropriations. What I am happy to share with you is that we did get out of the original backlogs, and that was... you know, the funding really supported that. It's also on the backs of these hardworking Division of Public Assistance employees. It also was a lot of business process redesign, and I'm going to get into the technical aspects of what did we do and where are we at and where do we need to go in the future slides. So I'll save that for the future slides. But there was a lot of work that happened. And so what I want to share is that the original intent has been met. I think the future slides will talk about where we are and where do we need to go.
Follow-up?
Thank you. So if you could just keep in mind as you're doing that, if there is a need to adjust, we're here to support you and your work, particularly to make sure that we don't hear from our constituents about a four-hour phone call waiting and then still getting hung up on and not getting to SNAP for months. So that would be fabulous to hear if you do need any support. And the moving to childcare and food security, would you also elaborate on that piece? Because I know childcare is one of our top priorities in welcoming families.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Galvin. One important aspect that I did not mention was back in March of 2023, we were at a 28% timeliness rate. We are now currently, and we toggle between 60 to 90% timeliness. So we've made significant improvement in terms of processing our applications. We still have work to do. We need progress, but we've made progress. In terms of childcare, that was an appropriation for $7.5 million. That funding went out to child care providers. The application was open in January, and the funding went out at the end of January, beginning of February. And those needs were met for that appropriation, which was one time. It was operational expenses. For the food security, there was a competitive RFP that went out, and it was awarded. And again, that was to provide food security, and it was awarded to the Food Bank of Alaska.
Thank you. Very quick follow-up.
Yes, follow-up.
With regard to the $7.5 million that was signed through the grant program, is it in your best estimation that we are that the child care facilities and that sector is no longer in need of support?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I would reference the work that we've done on the governor's task force on child care. There's a series of recommendations, and we are actively working through those recommendations. And so I think these one-time fundings did meet an initial need, but there's a lot of systemic work that we need to do within the child care, and we are actively working through those systemic changes right now in partnership with our child care providers. And I think it's those systemic changes to have sustainability is really important, and that's what we're working on right now.
Commissioner, I think the concern is there's such enormous bipartisan support for a fix, not in the future, not in the distant future, but immediately. And we're having problems, as you know, with SB 189. So even if the fiscal note had been timely, we've got some issues with that. We see the reverse of the one-time funding on child care. and then there was significant federal reversals or subtractions, were there not?
Chair Josephson, yes, there were. So there's two federal appropriations that were that will be removed from the budget this FY25. There are COVID monies, America Rescue Plan monies, both for the child care program. One is just upwards of $17 million. One is upwards of $11 million. So they'll be spent throughout FY25, but they do term.
Yeah. So this illustrates my grave concern. And this is a tough priority, for example, of the State Chamber of Commerce now. So I think what, if I could speak for Representative Galvin, is we feel like we need investment now. But there's no question. It's just a comment. I'm going to go to Representative Hannon, then Foster, then Stapp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Halloran, my question is about the extension of the senior benefits. And, give me, because it's not noted as a fiscal note, and I know that we passed a bill to extend the program that had lapsed, and that 470 doesn't approach when it's a $24 million program. Is that what I see up in the upper part of that slide?
Representative Hannon, through the chair. The small increase that you're seeing for the senior benefit program. So, yes, the senior benefit program, their overall budget for FY26 is $24 million. There's a small increment of $470,800, and that's to address the increased population entering the program.
Okay. We'll follow up. Do you know, Ms. Halloran, how long it has been since we increased the payment amount on those? I know that we have three different levels of payout. And a couple of years ago, it had been static. And so I am curious when the last time we changed the amount that our senior benefits pays to our impoverished seniors.
For the record, this is Commissioner. We can follow up with that.
Okay. All right. We're going to go to Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I've got one comment and two questions. First, my comment is I had a meeting with Commissioner Hedberg as well as Director of Division, Director of the Division of Public Assistance, Etheridge, after our morning's meeting. I just really appreciate them coming in and speaking with me. You know, my issue has been just our office has been inundated on the SNAP backlog issue, and it might just be it sounds like it might be a lot of it kind of in our area, maybe Western Alaska. Sounds like maybe statewide to some extent also, but really in our area. And so I appreciate just, you know, giving us some attention to try to figure out some solutions on that. My question is with regard to the SNAP backlog money, that's what goes away if we're not spending this $8.8 million, is that staff? Is that third-party contracting support? Is that technology? What goes away if we're reversing that money?
Yeah, for the record, this is Heidi Hedberg. So that funding was to pay for long-term non-perms, and so those long-term non-perms end at the end of the calendar year. It also provided support, contractual support, and so we are currently actively working on conversations and looking at how we can meet the needs and stay current with our timeliness in processing. And we'll follow up with House Finance later.
Okay. And follow up on that question?
Yes, follow up.
How many non-perms about would go away? You had mentioned
through the chair, Representative Foster, 30.
About 30. Okay, thank you. And then my second question, Representative.
Yep. Second question.
Co-Chair Josephson. I can't remember if we had a legislative budget and audit meeting recently, a few weeks ago. I can't remember, and so I'm trying to be careful if we were in executive session or not. I believe that, you know, as all departments undergo their regular audits, was the one that with regard to the SNAP issues and so forth, was that's a report that hasn't been released yet, and I think, are they still working with you, in which case I won't ask any more questions.
Through the chair, Rep. Foster, this is Pam Halloran, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health. That we received the management letter just this week, and so there's an internal process that's still occurring where we respond before that letter is final.
Okay, thank you. So I think at this point that sounds like that was ongoing, and you'll be working with them, and at some point there will be a report, and we can kind of look to that. So, okay, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. I'm probably going to go a little rapid fire here. So first, with the end of the long-term non-perms with the, let's say, addressing the SNAP backlog. So last time I checked, you guys had a rather significant payment error rate among that program. Also, the legislature recently passed a bill that would probably increase the amount of applications that you are going to be seeing for this program in a relatively short time frame. I believe the effective date on that's going to be July 1. So my question is, have we looked at how many, are we anticipating a spike in applications when you guys have to move toward the requirements of the bill that this body passed last year in the summertime, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, thanks for that question. So the broad-based categorical eligibility is what you are referencing. That is scheduled. We're working on IT modernizations right now. We are absolutely committed to not falling behind on our timeliness. That is our number one goal right now. And so I think as it implements, we are going to have to make some decisions as it moves forward. And we are always evaluating where we're at with our staffing needs and our operations. In terms of the payment error rate for SNAP, what I want to acknowledge is when I stepped into this role facing, 13,000 SNAP households that needed their benefits, they qualified. At the time, the certification period was 6 months. And I made the decision and I notified our federal partners that I was moving from 6 months to 12 months. When we made that decision to prioritize getting the food to Alaskans that qualify the SNAP benefits, that took all of those cases that would have gone through the quality control process and eliminated that, which artificially inflated our payment error rate. In addition, because we were not compliant with interviews, again, that was another element that artificially inflated our payment error rate. We have now resolved both of those. But yes, we recognize that the payment error rate was artificially inflated, and it is going down.
And a follow-up, Mr. Coacher.
Yes, follow-up.
Yep, thank you, Coacher. Justin, through the chair. How many applications across all programs are currently in backlog, through the chair?
Through the yes. For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Representative Stapp. Specific, is the question for SNAP or is it all applications?
To clarification, Mr. Kutcher, it's all programs, and I feel really bad about making you talk right now, just saying that. Like, I don't know if you can kick the answer to somebody else. I feel mean asking a question through the chair. So.
Through the chair,
it
Representative
is a bit mean. But we're going to see if she can handle it.
It's okay. I want to actually, I will state that we have 29,000. The issue with that number is that represents all programs. Of that 29,000, 21,000 are Medicaid. And the issue with Medicaid, and that's where I'm going to pause and actually turn it over to Director Etheridge, we actually have issues with our data system, and that is not an actual reflection of the untimely processing.
Director Etheridge, thanks for joining us. Question about...
Thank you. For the record, this is Deb Etheridge, Director for the Division of Public Assistance. And I can just, I'll just launch in. So the Medicaid backlog, as it shows right now, is around 21,000 applications. And what we know with that number is that the data is not clean or correct. Individuals apply for Medicaid benefits. I talked earlier this morning through an online portal through our federally facilitated marketplace, or they go on to My Alaska and apply, or they can drop an application off. In our system, we are unable to at times deduplicate. We can't tell if something's an application or if it's a renewal form. We also can't, because of our timeliness issues that we've experienced, people will submit multiple applications to us for Medicaid, and then if they change a household, we'll get additional applications. And so we've gone through various exercises to sort of deduplicate and comb through that data. At one point in time, it was closer to 28,000. We were able to clear just over 7,000 of those to show that they were duplicated. The other issue is that our ARIES system, which manages our modified adjusted gross income, will essentially shut down in the middle of someone processing an application. It won't let them close it. And so then the eligibility worker has to transition and open the Medicaid in our legacy system called EIS, Eligibility Information System. What that does is it leaves a MAGI application hanging out there as if there's no benefit, but actually the person is open and receiving services. So, we're about to go out to an RFP to modernize the non-MAGI Medicaid category, which at that time will be correcting the issue that we're experiencing in ARIES and have a better fidelity in our data.
Follow-up, Co-Chair. Yeah, I think Co-Chair Joseph, my apologies to the committee for kind of monopolizing this line of questioning too. But I know all the things you've just talked about, and the reason I had you describe them for the committee is because when I see an existing backlog, and there are very good reasons for that, by the way, you know, EIS runs on COBOL software, for folks who didn't know that. And I know that a law that we passed is going to, in theory, open up the public assistance to many more applications than you have normally processed through that. And you're having technical issues with ARIES, which have been going on since we created that. I get a little concerned about the elimination of the long-term non-PERN folks who are there to kind of assist with all that. Because, you know, I can see, let's call it the writing on the wall. And I'm just curious. I mean, I know you guys have done an excellent job and you plan really well, but I don't really want to trade one backlog and SNAP for a bunch of other backlogs and all the other programs, if that makes sense through the chair. So are we sure that when we go through the summertime that we're going to be able to keep up, if not just with SNAP, but ensure Medicaid applications are timely and delivered to all the folks through the chair.
Any testifier?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, I can absolutely commit. The department, this is a top priority that we meet the timeliness on processing these applications. And while we have made progress, we still have work to do. And so we recognize the concerns around the broad-based categorical eligibility. There are different aspects to it. One, there is an administrative burden that is reduced by implementing the broad-based categorical eligibility. I think it's the tight coordination between the Commissioner's Office and the Division of Public Assistance, where we meet on an almost daily basis as we are working through and triaging. Where are we at? Where is our staff? How can we support them? What are we at with our numbers, and how can we create efficiencies? I think moving on to the future slides will really demonstrate how we've categorized these efficiencies and the progress to date and where we're going to move to.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. I share some of the concerns with solving most of the problem of the well-publicized backlog and have some anxiety about retreating from our improved position. But let's move on to slide 11.
For the record, this is Pam Halloran, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health. I wanted to highlight one additional thing that why we did reference that 30 positions were leaving specific to the SNAP backlog. There was another multi-year for specific to Medicaid eligibility determinations, and that was another 30 positions. So for full transparency, I just wanted to clarify that. Moving on to slide 11, slide 11 provides comparison of the budget for the Division of Public Assistance from 24 through 26. The decrease from FY25 management plan is just over 13 million UGF and 35 million federal. Contributing factors include the reversals we just discussed and two large ARPA American Rescue Plan multi-year appropriations within the Child Care Assistance Program, which we also just discussed.
Assistant Commissioner, I want to do a little bit of a mop-up on slide 10. You said something that caused me to come back to it. You mentioned the redeterminations, and I'm convinced that to the extent you had personnel working on that, I wish them luck. But if they're not needed, they're not needed. I get that. I mean, if they can be hired in some other capacity, that's all the better. But the staff, you noted, I think, that the staff working on child care and food security is often the same staff working on addressing the SNAP backlog. Is that right?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, to the chair, no, very different. The reference was the reduction. The multi-year reversal for Medicaid unwinding had long-term non-perms associated with it, and the SNAP had long-term non-perms associated. They're both being reversed out. Child care and the food security were funding that went directly through the Department of Health out to providers or to the Food Bank of Alaska.
Okay. Sorry for the confusion. All right, so we're at slide 11. Are we now on slide 12? Okay, slide 12.
So for the record, Heidi Hedberg, slide 12, what I wanted to just take a step back is recognize that there's a tremendous amount of work that flows through the Division of Public Assistance. And what you can see on this slide is really a monthly representation of recipients. It's the number of Alaskans that are leveraging any one of these programs. And where we were back in March of 2023 with a 28% timeliness was at an all-time low. And it truly was coming out of the pandemic. The federal changes, rule changes, were being implemented, and it was really faced with how do we support our staff? How do we support the clients that need benefits? And really the mission of the division, which is to provide financial assistance and help them towards self-sufficiency. And so what I want to share with you is that we have made great strides over the past 2 years. And the next slide will really dive into what were the changes and what have we made and how are we making progress. But I am very happy to share with you, as you look down here, there's 65,778 Alaskans that are on supplemental nutrition assistance, otherwise known as SNAP, and that is a significant increase than where it was 2 years ago.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chairman. Commissioner, back on slide 12, and I'm going to I'm going to just use senior benefits, averaging monthly 10,663 in recipients. Would those people also be likely counted in the SNAP benefits, that they are 10 of the 65,000 Alaskans receiving SNAP, or are they only counted once in these assistance columns?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Deb Etheridge, Director for Public Assistance, through the chair, Representative. They could be duplicated. So they could be receiving a senior benefit. They also may be receiving a Medicaid benefit or a SNAP benefit.
And one follow-up?
Follow-up.
And are they likely also to qualify for adult public assistance? Or is that the requirement for working-age folks? Is that...
Through the chair, Representative, adult public assistance is for age blind and disabled, and it's a supplemental program for individuals who are low income and on supplemental security income.
Okay. So they could be. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. 13.
Yes. For the record, Heidi Hedberg. So really, faced with a crisis that was happening within the Division of Public Assistance, really building out a solid leadership team was the first step. And I'm just incredibly thankful for Deb Etheridge and stepping into a role that was very difficult and working with staff through a lot of change management. So on this slide, slide 13, what you can see is we took the arcs of effort, the work in front of us, and we really drilled it down into four different areas: client engagement, workforce enhancements, policy streamlined, and IT improvements. And so what I'd like to do is just share with you how we have been really focusing in on how we can simplify the process for clients that are applying for public assistance. We now have all offices that are open to same-day service. So an Alaskan can walk in, with their supporting documentation, complete the application, if it's required, have their interview, and have a determination made. And that's progress that wasn't there a couple of years ago. In addition, we have our virtual contact center, and we have increased staffing for our virtual contact center. We have also moved and shifted a lot of our applications to be online. So all of our applications now are online, and we are really leveraging smart form technology. So if an Alaskan says yes, it drops down and there's additional questions that are asked. If they say no, it passes them on. So it's really condensing the amount of time and individual spins trying to complete an application. We are working on a multi-program application, and so it's a singular application, and it will be a smart form that really helps clients with the yes or no's and really applying for the benefits. It will also help with the application processing by our eligibility technicians. In addition, last summer, we launched Alaska Connect. And so Alaskans can go to My Alaska, and they can log in, and there's Alaska Connect portal. They can submit their application, renew their benefits, report a change of status, or upload documents. That's phase one. Phase two, which I'm personally really excited about because it really opens up and gives that client the information that they are typically calling the virtual contact center. And phase two launches this summer. And that will have clients will then have the ability to update their demographics. So if they move, as an example, they'll be able to update their address. They'll be able to see the notices that were mailed. They'll have reminder dates on when their application is up for renewal or when they need to engage in an interview. They'll also be able to see their benefit amounts. So we really are providing a lot more information to our clients, really assisting them in making sure that they have access to that. That will be launching this summer. In addition, we've mentioned that we've leveraged text messaging, so we're sending reminders out for Medicaid and for SNAP, reminding Medicaid recipients they need to renew their application or SNAP when they're about ready to receive a phone call for their interview, and that's really helped. And then lastly, in terms of client engagement, a couple of years ago, we adopted what is known as a one-and-done model. So when a client calls or comes in, that eligibility technician is working with them, they're going to look at, see all of the applications that they have applied for, and they're going to process all of those applications as much as they can with that client right there. That one-and-done model has been an operational shift. It's a business process redesign that has really helped with the efficiency of the flow of the information that is flowing through the Division of Public Assistance. It is heartwarming. I have been out in the community just in the last week and hearing from some of the social services organizations like My House, Catholic Social Services, the Food Bank of Alaska, that has noticed that these enhancements for our clients is really making a difference. I do want to acknowledge that Alaskans that are living in rural communities, we are still hearing that there's connectivity issues with unstable internet, and we are really open to ideas on how we can continue to meet the needs of those that individuals that are living in rural communities and may not have that stable internet. In terms of workforce enhancements, we have really been working really hard to support our employees. We have a high turnover rate, and that's multifactorial, but really trying to improve the culture and the work environment for our staff. So a couple of years ago, part of the work we did was we have security in our large offices that really ensures that the staff can come and they feel safe working and they can de-escalate situations when they arise. In addition, I believe it was last year, the Division of Public Assistance leveraged what is known as Qualys. It's a survey tool. And so we're sending it out to our employees to gather information. We're sending it out to providers to gather information. We want to hear what are the issues and do you have any solutions? How can we create more efficiencies? which then that tool helps lead us into our quality improvement process, where when we're identifying errors, we're looking at the root cause analysis. How can we improve that for operational efficiencies? In addition, as we have been touring many of the offices, we noticed they had really small screens, and so that was an easy fix, just getting larger screens for them to view the information on the website and increasing that internet bandwidth as much as possible in our communities for the efficiency of our staff. And then we just completed, maybe a few quarters ago, our business process redesign on our training unit. So we are now leveraging adult training theory, which really condensed down the amount of time that eligibility technicians are in training, and so that they are able to start processing applications faster under supervision until they feel more comfortable. And that really has been a game changer for many of our employees that really enjoy this new training model. And then finally, I think just the open door, we have had a lot of town halls and meeting with our staff and hearing what their ideas are and what their needs are and how we can improve the work for them. So that's what we're doing with our workforce enhancements.
Just a quick pause. Coach, did you have a question?
Comments?
Yes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Met with the commissioner earlier and shared my internet viewpoints, and I just wanted to maybe also share with the committee. For a lot of my folks out in the villages, if they don't have money for food, they probably don't have money for internet. And whereas for folks in maybe a more urban area, you know, you could go to the public library. We don't have public libraries, in our villages. And for some of the folks who maybe do have a little bit of technology, they've got a phone, and whereas I've got a nice iPhone and I can do a lot of my applications online, this past summer I was out in 27 villages and I saw a lot of old flip phones out there, and I saw the types of phones where, you know, you got to hit the button three times to get a P and twice to get an N and so forth. And so trying to do applications online, I absolutely support, you know, the direction we're moving in terms of trying to be more technologically innovative. But at the same time, I guess my ask would be that we also keep some level of old school resources in place also, meaning, for example, phones and just folks who can staff those phones. Because it's just really amazing that when you see some of the folks out there who are really struggling, and like I say, you know, we really take for granted that a lot of folks, you know, in a lot of areas have internet, but boy, you get out into some of the places there and it's really, really, really different. So anyway, thank you for that.
Sure. Representative Allard.
Thank you. And I'm through the chair, and I wanted to reference what Representative Foster had said, and it correlates very well with our seniors that are veterans as well. Mm-hmm. We do need to be able to have it in paper. And we have C boxes where veterans can try to call in, or they have staff that they speak to that still do the paper. Because it's very difficult, because when you're dealing with people, dear Lord, I struggle sometimes on electronics. And so when you're dealing with individuals that are living in the remote areas, or 16 above, I want to say, it's hard technology-wise to get the things done that we need. So whatever we need to do to be able to support that, I think we need to stick to it. There is such a thing as pen and paper still. And I just don't think it's always efficient to go through the internet as much as sometimes just getting that person on the phone and taking that application or whatever needs to happen with it. So I just want to show my support for Representative Foster, and we have to come up with a better plan for those rural communities.
Okay. Yeah. Thoughts? For the record, Heidi Hedberg, I really appreciate Representative Foster and Representative Allard for your comments. We still receive a large volume of paper applications that flow through our division. I was talking to a federal agency recently, and I said, you have to understand, we have to have one foot in the basics and one foot in technology. And if you can make it work in Alaska, you can make it work in any other state. And so I fully agree with you.
Okay. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair, to our fine people from the Department of Health. So I see, since you're talking about workforce enhancement, I see that nearly 24% of your workforce either telecommute or work remotely, work from home. Is that a trend that's going up? Is there more people working from home or less people, less of your workers working from home? Or how does that work for workforce enhancement and, you know, happy workers? Is that working for you?
Through the chair, this is Deb Etheridge, Director for Division of Public Assistance, through the chair representative. When I started, most of the Division of Public Assistance staff were working as in a telework environment. We didn't have the public assistance offices open. And so through the process of reopening our public assistance offices, our staff have come back into the office and are working so that they can meet the individuals where they are in the office and provide the same-day service. Generally, our office and people are working at least 4 days a week in our office. And then at the minimum, we do have some staff who don't have direct client service that can work maybe 1 or 2 days a week in the office and will telework the rest. And then, of course, if we're seeing people needing some additional support, we may ask them to come back from a telework agreement into the office so that we can provide them enhanced support.
A follow-up. So is this a rotation of folks that are teleworking? I just have a snapshot. This is from October of 2024 with the 23% working from home. So is that just a snapshot of in time? Is it shrinking the number, or are they on rotations where some are coming in? And, you know, so is this, I guess, a little better explanation on how that's working?
Through the chair, representative. That would be a snapshot in time. And so we have an increase in number of staff who are working in the office larger spans of time. So we do have a number of staff who have telework agreements, but those agreements are maybe they're working telework 1 day a week or 2 days a week, or they have a telework agreement so that they can work overtime from their home. But that 23%, that would be a snapshot, and it does change.
Okay.
I feel like I didn't answer your question.
Okay. I think we could chat about it.
Okay.
Off the record.
Okay.
Thank you.
And that was specific to your division, I assume, Ms. Etheridge.
To the chair, yes, that is specific to my division.
Okay. Representative Allard.
Thank you, and through the chair. So I'm going to circle back with what Representative Tomaszewski was hitting on. How large is your division again, please?
Just over 400 employees.
Through the chair.
Follow.
How many of those, and he might have said it, how many of those employees telework?
Through the chair, Representative, I'd have to get back to you to know the exact number of individuals. I don't have that right with me right now.
Okay.
Significant number, though.
Significant, may I?
Yes, you may.
So something else I want to know, too, then, is since you have to get back to us, will they be coming back in to brief us?
Very unlikely.
Okay. So we won't
be. We like them, but very unlikely.
Very unlikely. Okay. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if you have somebody who takes applications or customer service and then you have somebody else that takes it, I think I want to know the difference between the productivity. So if someone is in the office, do they take more applications or productivity than those aren't? How often does the ones who are in the office full time end up taking less or more sick leave or vacation? However it works, I want to compare apples to apples. But I have a concern that the productivity is not as good as if you're in the office, and I want to see those numbers. And I would think, and just don't be offended, but
yeah.
I would think that when we're doing a presentation like this, like you would think we were going to ask these, because I really want it to be on public record. And if we're not going to hear back from you guys, thank you, Chair.
Through the chair, Representative, I think I understand your question now, and so I need to explain just to offer some assurance about how work happens at the Division of Public Assistance with our eligibility workers. We operate what's called on a statewide basis, and we use a workflow management tool called Current. That workflow management tool, our eligibility workers are all assigned a skill set. And so if an eligibility worker is just learning how to do, for example, SNAP and Medicaid only, then that's their skill set. If an eligibility worker can work all programs, then that's their skill set. The work is received by our eligibility technician ones. They're registered in our system, and they're assigned to be worked through our current workflow management system. An eligibility worker has to what's called claim next in our current system. We can tell exactly how much time an individual is taking to process a case. We know how many cases they've worked on. We know how much time they've spent idle because they do all the work in the workflow management system. When I was initially started, we set a baseline of you have to work 5 cases a day, and or you would come back into the office to receive additional support. Through some really continuous quality improvement, what we realized that 5 cases a day was really arbitrary because it didn't reflect difficult cases versus easy cases to work. And so we would have people maybe not producing as much as they could because 5 was the standard, or producing what looked like less, but they were taking more difficult cases. And so now what we've transitioned to is called key performance indicators. Our supervisors supervise staff based on their productivity in those key performance indicators. And it's really based on, as the statewide, how long it average takes for transaction times depending on the programs. And there's a daily report that the supervisors have access to that they can monitor their individuals, whether they're in the office or not in the office. And then our supervisors will step in when someone's taking too long to process a case. And if we see consistent lower productivity, those individuals are likely back in the office. We pull people back into the office if we experience people not producing.
May I just quick comment, Chair?
Quick follow-up.
Thank you. I appreciate that because I think that's what a lot of people publicly are wondering, right? Well, they're working at home. They're not doing their job. But it sounds like you have a really good checks and balances in place. Thank you for the explanation. I super appreciate that. It makes me feel better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Through the chair. I should have made that clear.
That was excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Sure. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair. We were talking a little bit about workforce enhancements and workforce development. I was wondering what your relationship is with our friends over in labor and workforce, and what kind of cross work you guys are doing to not only help them with their work, but for them to help you with your work. I was hoping you could speak to that.
Through the chair, Representative, we have a fairly close working relationship with the Department of Labor. Our offices are often co-located with the Department of Labor. We are in Juneau, for example, in the same building, separate floors with Labor. And Kenai, you actually walk through the Department of Labor to get to our eligibility office. One of the things that we experience is often people will be applying for positions within the Division of Public Assistance, and then if they struggle with completing the application, we'll refer them to the Department of Labor, who will help them fill out and complete their application. And really, it's a gateway for them not only to become better applicants for the Division of Public Assistance, but also for any other position that they may want. Or the Department of Labor may be working with an individual and is aware that the Division of Public Assistance has positions open. So, for example, in Fairbanks, there's flyers that are outside the Department of Labor. We also have, within the Division of Public Assistance, for our SNAP, we have an employment and training program, and for TANF, we also have a work services program that assists people who at times will move from those work programs into and become public assistance employees.
And a follow-up. Through the chair, do you also work with workforce development for helping develop your workforce as well?
Through the chair, this is Deb Etheridge. We have programs to support staff when they need support and through workforce development, and we may refer them if they need some support in learning, but nothing specific. And although I have spoken with labor, but nothing specific.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, and through the chair. Thank you for those key performance indicator discussion. That was really good and helpful. My data shows just the whole department. It wasn't just specifically to yours. So it's the whole department. And I just wonder, so my question is now, does it cost more for the department to have a teleworker? Like, is there other besides their salary cost involved in that? I mean, they probably take their laptop from work and they probably take it home and they do their work there. But is there any other costs associated with a teleworker other than just or other costs than being at work at their cubicle or wherever they would be?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, no. I'm not aware of any other costs that... Telework is just an agreement of where you work. We don't pay for anything at their house.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we were on slide 13. Policy streamlined.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg. So policy streamlining, I think this is a really important area that we are focusing in on. So as I mentioned before, one of the first decisions that we made was shifting and extending that certification period for SNAP from 6 months to 12 months. Again, it reduces the churn of Alaskans coming in every 6 months for renewal. And we've also become fully compliant with our SNAP interviews, which is part of our business process redesign on our training program. In addition, on December 1st of 2024, USDA gave us approval for our Elderly Simplified Assistance Project, also known as ESAP. These are adults that are age 60 or older and have a disability. That is qualified by Food Nutrition Services, the federal agency. Currently, if an individual qualifies for the Elderly Simplified Assistance Project, well, before December, it was a 24-month certification period. We have now extended that to 36 months. And really, that provides that continuity for this population. It also... really evens out a lot of the certifications for eligibility technicians. When we made that shift, that's 41% of the SNAP population. So that was very significant. In addition, I will pass it over to Dr. Etheridge, and she can talk about Work Assist and Rural Alaskan interviews.
For the record, this is Deb Etheridge. We have taken on several steps to look at how we can administratively simplify our programs and provide better customer service to Alaskans. One of the areas that we have found in through our continuous quality improvement working with our staff is that we recognize that staff are finding it very difficult to get their basic questions answered. So if they have a question about eligibility, what income to count, who's a household member, what dates of employment to look at, for example, and they have to stop their work to ask one of their peers or a trainer that question or hunt through our manuals, it's taking a significant amount of time and energy away from our eligibility technicians just doing their job. And so one of the projects that we are undergoing is essentially creating a closed search engine that will, a worker is going to be able to log in, ask a question, whatever their question is, and then when it comes back, the answer to that question will be in a plain language and at a reading level that they could easily, if they had to translate that answer into a notification to an individual, that would be very clear to read. And it's also going to point directly back to where they found the information in our policy manuals. And so that's sort of an arc of effort that we're going to, one, it really provides better customer service to our staff, which are working really hard, but also ensures more quality decisions are made and decreases our error rate in all of our programs. The other is Alaska's very special, and we have a very special section of the Farm Bill. Some of you may be familiar with fee agents. So in rural Alaska, anybody who lives outside of a 50-mile radius of a public assistance office, you can have a fee agent in your community, and that fee agent really serves as a delegate of the division, of the state. That fee agent can take that application, and then that preserves your preserves your date of application along with your interview. It's difficult to get people to want to be fee agents, and so we another section within that farm bill is that we have the ability and have sought the ability and authority from FNS to do what's called postponement of interview. So that means for SNAP cases, if you live in a rural area, we will receive your application. We'll do a cold call to you to try to conduct your interview. If you do not answer your phone, we will leave you a message and say we're going to call you back in 5 minutes. If we're unable to reach you, especially, and this is really important for expedites, if we're unable to reach you, we are going to certify and get your benefits out to you, and then schedule an interview for you and give you enough time for the mail to actually reach you so that you can make your interview, because we now have an interview queue on our virtual contact center and a missed interview queue on our contact center, because lots of times the mail gets there after the person's actual interview is scheduled. And so recognizing that, we'll also be doing the exact same thing for recertifications and applications. The only caveat with recertifications and applications is that we're going to have the verifications we need in order to certify. But lots of times people will turn in information and we'll have the verifications. So this is for rural Alaska, and we think it's going to be, I'm just going to say it, a game changer. You know, it's going to really increase our ability to be timely on those applications, and we're only issuing benefit for up to 1, maybe 2 months, just depending on when we need to do those interviews. Very similar for expedite. And expedite means you have less than $150. And so it's really critical that we're able to be responsive to Alaskans.
Questions from Representative Bynum and then Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair, the fee agent. How is this person paid? Is this paid through the federal program? Or, like, what does that mechanism look like for trying to get this person? Because you indicated that it seems that it could be a difficult thing to find. Mm-hmm. So how is this person paid?
Through the chair, Representative, what they do is they go through a training program with the Division of Public Assistance. They enter into sort of a contract, and they get paid on a per-application basis, and it's a relatively low amount. It's $25 per application. And then we set up a payment source within our – they have to send us an invoice, and then we reimburse them.
Follow up.
So those costs, are those borne by the state of Alaska, or are those passed through from the federal farm bill?
Through the chair, Representative, those are expenditures on the state of Alaska.
Okay. And then it's one other quick follow-up. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. So the you talked about using phone calls as an option to work with clients to get applications and things filled out. Are we using teleconference resources when we're dealing with folks, or only telephone?
Through the chair, at this time it's telephone.
Thank you.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. My question is for the commissioner. When you were talking about elderly simplified application certification, extending it up to 36 months, and then you said, and here's how I scribble it down, that is 41% of our SNAP. So 41% of our SNAP beneficiaries are elderly.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, they need to be 60 years or older and a disability. as defined by Food Nutrition Services, FNS, which is part of USDA.
To qualify for that elderly simplified application, but I'm, when you said 41% of SNAP, so of our total SNAP, are they that much or they're 41? That's what, when you presented that, because I've always thought that we have far more families on SNAP, you know, so a family with three or four kids, so it threw me off, but maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're presenting.
For the record, this is Deb Etheridge, Director for Public Assistance. Through the chair, representative, it's a household. And so the members of the household have to be age disabled, and then they could also have children that are not of working age. So it is families. It could represent families.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Are we on slide 14?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg. So on slide 14, I really want to just do a very brief overview on our IT modernizations. And I want to first thank the legislature. 2 years ago, there was a large appropriation to pay for this modernization. And so when we talk about IT modernization, it's really helpful to break it down. What are we talking about? So first, on the right-hand side of the screen, you're going to see ARES maintenance and operations. One of the first things that our small but mighty project management office team within the Division of Public Assistance did, working with contractors, is that they shifted our document management system and ARES into the cloud. And this really positioned us for future advancements by aligning these updates to our technical infrastructure. It also provides easier access to this data in a more secured, adaptable way. From there, you can see down on the left-hand side where it says Integrated Eligibility Enrollment System, and you see the roadmap. This is the goal. We have Representative Stapp sort of mentioned that we have antiquated systems. That appropriation is to get us from our current position to where we need to be, and it's that Integrated Eligibility Enrollment System. We have two RFPs that will be going out this year. One is to migrate the non-MAGI categories off of the mainframe. The second is to migrate the SNAP off the mainframe. And so we're very much looking for those RFPs to go out soon and for contractors to start working on that. And then once those two are migrated off, then we'll migrate TANF and the cash programs off. It is estimated to be completed by the year of 2028. The second area that I want to focus in on is our enhanced client engagement. I've already talked about many of these things. Again, the check marks represent what we have already accomplished. We are texting. We have a secured document upload. We have multiple e-forms, really moving from paper-based to e-forms, recognizing we need to still keep paper for some of our clients. And then the phase two of our client portal is launching. And then finally, if you look down under operational efficiencies, this morning, Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie talked about our automated ex parte process for Medicaid. This really is an automated process that will really help with the redetermination, and there's a lot of efficiencies that will be gained by increasing our ex parte process. As well as we have, we'll be working on We've also, November 2024, we leveraged some technology, and so now when we have the emails that come in that have applications or renewals, we have technology that will identify them, pull them out, and put them into our document management system. And that is going really well. The next three things that we'll be working on in the coming year is our data integrations between all of our platforms. Really, this is going to help so that our eligibility technicians and our clerical staff are not having to toggle between multiple different platforms. They can work in their the solution that they have in front of them, and the information will be ebbing and flowing. And then secondly, Asset verification is an important tool for verifying that an individual qualifies for public assistance. It's a manual process right now, and so we are going to be working to automate that process so that it reduces the amount of time that eligibility technician is spending processing that application. And then finally, we are still required to mail out a lot of notifications. And when it mails out and it hits the wrong address, that mail comes back in. And we receive a large volume of snail mail. And so there's equipment out there that we'll be purchasing that really automates the mail coming back in. It will scan it and upload into our system the new address so that we can make sure to connect in with our clients. And then finally, you know, within the Division of Public Assistance, we've spent a lot of time talking about our public assistance programs, but there's two other areas that we have as well within the division. One is family nutrition, and so that's the Women, Infant, Children program. They have a new system called Spirit that went live, and it's a phased rollout. And then the Child Care Program Office, they have the new Alaska Child Care Information System that has launched, and it's a phased rollout to the public as well.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair. You'd mentioned an appreciation to the legislature for providing funds for this capital investment into this new infrastructure. Is there any concerns from your department about the ability to maintain this new technology as we move into the future? Meaning, are your current budgets sufficient enough to maintain the infrastructure?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Representative Bynum, right now we feel confident with the funding that we have to support these. There's going to be a lot of cost savings when we are moving off of the mainframe. And so I think through the transition of the technologies that we're gaining and getting off of the old legacy, we're going to be able to maintain the budget that we have.
Thank you.
Okay, slide 15.
For the record, this is Pam Halloran. Slide 15 highlights the Division of Behavioral Health. This division identifies behavioral health needs across Alaska and develops and implements strategies to meet those needs. The division maintains Alaskans' behavioral health system in partnership with grantees and providers. The division's budget is just over $94 million, and there are three budget changes that we wanted to highlight for you today. The first is a $1.5 million request for a crisis call center. This request comprises of 750,000 mental health trust receipts and 750,000 general fund mental health funding. The call center provides for 24/7 statewide coverage for 988 calls, as well as 1-877-266-HELP. The call center provides for a free confidential talk line for Alaskans who are at risk of suicide or who are in emotional distress. The call center has been in operation for over 20 years and has answered the suicide prevention line, which is now 988, calls since the lifeline began. The current call center contract started in 2022, and it ends at the end of this fiscal year, June 30, 2025. The Department of Health will issue a new request for proposals for a new contract. There's been an increase in Alaskans utilizing the call center in recent years, resulting from a statewide and national media campaigns. In recent years, the contract has partially been supported by American Rescue Plan Act funding and other federal programs which are expiring. The $15 million is needed to maintain current services of the crisis call center. Our second item that we wanted to highlight for you is a reduction of designated program receipts, specifically the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund, Recidivism Reduction Fund, the Alcohol Drug Treatment and Prevention Fund, and the Tobacco Cessation and Education Fund. They each will be decreased, and for the Division of Behavioral Health, that decrease is $3.7 million. The division primarily uses those funds for grants and reimbursable services agreements with other state agencies. The final change that we wanted to highlight for you is $5 million increase federal authority for the division. The division manages at any given time 20 different federal grant awards. The additional authority would allow for the division not to have to hold back and toggle funds from fiscal year to fiscal year and manage those awards effectively.
Assistant Commissioner Halloran, the reduction due to the decrease in marijuana education, treatment, alcohol, tobacco funds, et cetera, I look at that and I say, well, that's a source of revenue that's used to help solve problems. But the fact that the source of revenue is reduced doesn't mean the problems aren't there. Why not find a substitute source of revenue, I guess is my question. Or is there, are we to believe that the reduction means there's less use of intoxicating substances and so behavioral health problems? I mean, we're not making those statements, right?
To Chair Josephson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. Relying on those revenue sources, I think, is always challenging for programs because they do reflect certain variables that are outside of the state's control. So seeing the decrease in tax revenue, the division is thinking about kind of how can they mitigate the impact to existing programs. I think from our perspective, I can't speak to whether or not use of marijuana or tobacco is increasing or decreasing relative to the tax. I think that would be a question for the Department of Revenue. But we are looking again at some of the programs that are supported through those funding. Some of those programs are RSAs. I apologize for using an acronym. Reimbursable Services Agreements, thank you, to other divisions or departments within the state of Alaska. So we have given them some notice that this funding may be impacted based on tax receipts. And so we would continue to try to, again, think about how we can mitigate the impact of that reduction in funds. But I think that is a little bit of the nature of these variable programs.
Okay. Representative Galvin, then Hannon.
Thank you. And this is a follow-up to that previous line of thought. If these funds were being used toward better behavioral health opportunities, and as you say, it's inconsistent and difficult when that happens, then why not make a request for it to be consistent funding from the state? If it's truly... I think it's on your roadmap that this is kind of a big area for you now, and so I'm confused to see this because what you have here is federal receipt authority for grants. You're concerned about, maybe not concerned, but we are seeing a reduction from funds not available to you, but there is no ask for more to fill that, presumably, a hole of care.
Through the Chair, Representative Galvin, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I think it's important to put in context these grant funds as one of many funding streams that support a variety of different programs for behavioral health services across the state. So, you know, the $5 million in federal receipt authority is, you know, that is not intended for the same types of services that these other tax revenues have been used for. In terms of, the initiating of the funding source as, you know, a variable funding source via tax revenues, that was a decision that I think was made, I'm not sure when, but, you know, with the legislature evaluating how best to use these revenues, recognizing, again, that they're tax revenues and they will shift over time. I also think it's important to think back to the slide that we looked at earlier today, and I think is embedded in this presentation. While this may represent a decrease that the division will have to manage, there has also been over $122 million that have been added to the behavioral health system through the 1115 Medicaid waiver. Now, they may not translate into exactly the services that are supported through these grants, but I think, again, it's important to look at the entirety of the funds that are available to our behavioral health system. Admittedly, there are absolutely gaps that we want to work to address, but I think there has been significant strides in increasing the amount of funding from a state and a federal level to support the behavioral health system.
Follow-up? Thank you. I appreciate your assessment around and also your finding ways to distribute $122 million, I think is what you referred to. And I know that you've done a really great job building a roadmap, and I'm sure you've identified gaps. And I guess it's on us to ask you what those gaps are and on us to find ways to help you fill those gaps as we help you meet your mission of, you know, promoting an integrated and comprehensive behavioral health system. That's what this conversation's about.
Chair Josephson, if I could just add, you know, I think related to that, one area of focus for the department and an area that we have heard consistently about from behavioral health providers and that we see occurring naturally is the development of something called certified community behavioral health clinics. And, you know, as we highlight the additional $5 million in federal grant authority, a portion of that is because we were awarded, I think, in either early January or the end of December, over $1 million, I think $1.6 million from the federal government to pursue planning and development for implementing these certified community behavioral health clinics in Alaska. And it is a really promising model. We do have some clinics that are operating in Alaska, but they cannot receive kind of the enhanced funding that's available through the Medicaid program until the Medicaid program actually sets up its own certification system for these services. So with the federal grant funding that we receive for that, we can now begin planning out those services, and then we hope to begin implementation and be in that next cohort of states to begin that implementation work towards the end of this year. So again, there is a relation to how we're leveraging those federal grants to address some of the needs that we see in our behavioral health care system.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Ms. Halloran, my questions are around the crisis call center. I've been on the State Suicide Council as a legislative person, so intimately aware of them. I guess I'm didn't realize they weren't in your base budget, and or is this an additional $1.5 million anticipating an increase in the RFP, or were they not put into the budget because the contract for current operation is expiring?
Ms. Heller.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the Crisis Call Center has been in existence for over 20 years. So what's happened is that with the utilization has drastically increased with the advertisement and the marketing around 988. And so it's as a result, the need is greater, more staff, et cetera. I'm going to hand it over to DC Ritchie.
Ms. Ritchie.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, for the record, this is Emily Ritchie. You know, I think it's important. Yes, this is an additional increase to the amount that's been budgeted, but quite frankly, the crisis contact center is a little bit complicated to track over the years because it has been in existence for as long as Assistant Commissioner Pam Halloran has described, but also because the services it provides and the model of providing those services continue to evolve over time. So when we first think about like a suicide crisis line, I mean, that may be what I heard when I was growing up. Now it has kind of emerged into a crisis contact center. They're connecting with a federal requirement, 988, that makes those services available across the country and incorporating things like the ability to send text messages, the opportunity to try to follow up with individuals following their call, see if they can connect them into services, potentially even help them with an appointment. We also view the Crisis Contact Center as being essential to further establishing and building out our crisis stabilization and crisis response programs in Alaska. There has been some good work done on that, but that's another area where we think about parts of the continuum of care that we need to build out. Those crisis response and stabilization centers are part of that, and having that crisis contact center have the IT platform to be able to support that growth is key. So all of that is part of the reason why you see this increase. So I think about it almost as a shift or an evolution in what that model is over the last 20 years.
Chair Josephson, I've just a comment. I was going to say that's what I wanted to hear, that this is an expansion of it in response to the increased demand. And it's this next part is not on you, but I will tell you from serving on that council representing the legislature, what we hear continually
because it's been an effort nationwide, and in the states that have had the most success, it's also meant that that linked to some service. So Utah was the exemplar of the suicide crisis lines, that the University of Utah would then dispatch a crisis team to the phone caller, which, of course, can't happen in Alaska. Our crisis call center is in one location. And our rural communities, and this is not on you, it's on us, have no better response delivery than we had when we when 988 went live. So we've got to do a better job from our end to get more services available to respond to communities in crisis and people in crisis with suicide calls coming in. And we don't. The crisis center does an amazing job of trying to shore up, stabilize, get what they can. But in so many communities, there just aren't any services. And you know, it's one of those pieces of this federal rollout or effort that is so successful in so many other places. But we, as you all know, we don't have enough providers. We don't have enough access to care. We don't have crisis stabilization centers stood up. To, and I'll just use an example of a youth, bring them into a crisis stabilization center once they've made that lifeline call. But I am more than happy to advocate passionately for this additional money because 988 has saved lives.
Okay, let's go to slide 16, please.
Slide 16 provides a three-year comparison for the Division of Behavioral Health. The majority of their UGF is General Fund Mental Health Authority, which comprises 26% of their budget. The federal share of their budget is 31%.
Okay.
For the record, this is Pam Halloran. Apologies for
that. Continuing, slide 17.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. And for the committee, I don't know how much time you'd like me to spend on the slide, but again, it does represent some important shifts in how we fund the behavioral health system in Alaska.
Great. We have a question from Representative Tomaszewski, and then I want to take a look at what you've marked appendix, because these look important to me, if I've got the right document. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Chair Josephson, through the chair. So grant funding, real quick. So we give grants out to different organizations throughout the state. What is that funding? Is that federal? Is it state? How does that break out as far as the percentage-wise?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I would like to follow up to have that broken out in terms of what that $51 million is. But generally, this represents, I would say, the majority of general fund grant dollars that are being used in this line. But there is a level of federal grants through different federal entities that may also flow into the Division of Behavioral Health. And I'm, to be quite frank, I'm not actually sure how much of those may be included in these numbers. But my understanding is the vast majority of the amounts in green on the screen are UGF grant dollars.
Follow up. And also, if you could provide just the list in along those recipients and the breakdown, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
If we can move to slide 20, and if the three of you will draw our eyes to the most pertinent features, that'd be great.
Okay, slide 20 is this. For the record, this is Pam Halloran. One of these days I'll remember to do that. Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health. Slide 20 highlights the Department's Senior and Disability Services Division. This division's work comprises of Adult Protective Services, Assessment Review, Early Intervention, the Infant Learning Program, Grant Services, Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Unit, Provider Certification and Compliance, and more. The primary change is a companion change to one that we heard about in the Medicaid services appropriation, which is a reversal of an allocation, a multi-year appropriation for Inter-I.
Okay. Slide 21.
Slide 21 highlights that the Senior Disability Services budget is just under $73 million. This is a decrease of $1.5 million from management plan.
All right. Slide 22.
Slide 22 highlights a division of public health, and they're responsible for diagnosing and investigating health problems and hazards in Alaskan communities, informing Alaskans on health issues, mobilizing partnerships to identify and solve health problems, support community health efforts, provide linkage for Alaskans to health services, ensure adequate public health infrastructure, and monitor and evaluate health service effectiveness for the state of Alaska. Within this appropriation, there's one increase, which is general fund program receipts to increase SHARP 1. So this is stands for Strengthening Healthcare Access Recruitment Program. It's a program where we receive funds in the form of general fund program receipts from healthcare agencies across the state, and we match that with federal HRSA dollars. And I shouldn't have used an acronym, and it Health Resources Systems Administration Loan Repayment Program.
Thank you.
So those funds come in, and we're seeing increased utilization in agencies in that program. The Division of Public Health is also seeing a reduction related to designated general fund, much similar to the reduction that we discussed in the Division of Behavioral Health. Slide 23 highlights the Division of Public Health's the Division of Public Health's budget.
I
should have highlighted that. My apologies. There's also a reversal of several multi-year appropriations for COVID. Many of those appropriations are terming out, meaning they are multi-years that end at the end of this fiscal year. Others will be carried into FY26 in the amount of about $70 million of COVID monies will remain on the public health budget.
Right, and I'm remembering that exact number, and the intent is to do what with those dollars?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, the funding will be used for one-time expenditures. A lot of that is related to data integration. So as an example, at our state lab, we have the Laboratory Information Management System, and so that funding will be used for data integrations.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. With the reduction of designated general funds based on the Department of Revenue projections similar to BH, can you give us a sense of what will be lost in the Department of Public Health?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Representative Galvin. Right now, the Division of Public Health is looking at the budget overall to see how they can refocus their funding. So, as an example, the after-school program leverages some of these funds, and so they're going to make sure that those funds continue through FY26 as we continue to just evaluate our budget. How can we meet the needs with resources that we have?
Okay, thank you. So far I'm hearing that you're going to figure out a way to move things around. Maybe you have some vacancies or something so that you have the funds to cover what might normally be lost without those funds.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes, the division is making sure that we can take care of and evaluate.
Okay. Thank you.
Slide 23.
Slide 23 is the budget comparison from FY24 through FY26 for the Division of Public Health. Wanted to point out here that the Division of Public Health also administers two smaller appropriations for the department. That's a Human Services Community Matching Grant Program and the Community Initiative Matching Grant Program. The overall decrease for the Division of Public Health is just under $150 million. However, like I said, a number of those items will be rolling back into the department at the end of the fiscal year when we realize the year-end balances. And for the record, this is Pam Halloran.
All right, Department of Support Services.
Department Support Services provides for all health support functions within the department, including human resources oversight, procurement, grants and contracts, information technology, budget, finance and revenue, cost allocation, audit response, and administrative support, all items that support the department as a whole. Within this appropriation, there are two budget changes, including a request for an increase in interagency receipt authority so that the division can cost allocate chart support costs out to the department. There's also a reversal of a multi-year homeless management information system funding that is terming out at the end of this fiscal year.
Okay. I think we've done yeoman's work in two hearings. I want to thank you all, particularly for the record, Commissioner Hedberg, Deputy Commissioner Ritchie, Assistant Commissioner Pam Halloran. Our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is at 1:30 tomorrow, February the 14th. At that meeting, we will hear from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. They'll present their FY26 budget overview. Then we will hear the Department of Environmental Conservation present its FY26 budget overview. If I'm reading this right, we're going to focus on their Village Safe Water and Sewer programs. So with that, we will adjourn today's afternoon meeting at 3:23.